Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Hello, Ursula.
Hi, Susan, and welcome to all your listeners.
And now the weather. Today, a 40% chance of rain, mainly after 4 p.m., mostly cloudy, with a high near 38. South wind, 9 to 15 miles per hour, becoming north-northwest in the afternoon. Winds could get as high as 21 miles per hour. New precipitation amounts of less than a tenth of an inch possible. But tonight, snow, freezing rain, and sleet are likely before 2 a.m. Then a slight chance of snow between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. Mostly cloudy, with low around 18. Wind chill, as low as 10. Blustery, with a north wind 14 to 16 miles per hour with gusts as high as 22 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 70%. Little or no ice accumulation expected. New snow and sleet accumulation of less than half an inch possible. Saturday, mostly sunny with a high near 28. Wind chill values as low as 5. North wind 9 to 15 miles per hour with gusts as high as 18. Saturday night, mostly clear with a low around 15. Wind chill values as low as 5. Sunday, sunny with a high near 49. Breezy with south-southwest wind at 8 to 16 miles per hour with gusts as high as 21.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Susan Franzen and I, Ursula Rudenberg, are your hosts today. We're going to start off according to the phenology calendar with Pat Schlarbaum, with today's bird of note, the red-tailed hawk. Then KHOI's Rebecca Brown has started to focus on travel, and today we'll hear her first interview on that topic. She will speak with Jerry Rupert, Assistant Director of the Outdoor Recreation Program at Iowa State University, and he will tell us about his favorite traveling spots in Iowa.
Then we'll travel by phone to one town in our listening area, Collins. Mayor Brent Cummings will tell us about big plans they have in store for 2014. During the last part of the hour, we will speak with the former U.S. Congressman Bob Inglis. Mr. Inglis was in Ames recently, where he gave a lecture at the ISU lecture series called Engaging Conservatives on Energy and Climate.
So let's get started with KHOI reporter Pat Schlarbaum from the Department of Natural Resources talking about the beautiful and mighty red-tailed hawk.
Phenology is the recording of nature's happenings when they occur. The first woodland hepatica blooming in the spring, or the last osprey of autumn, are noted in a journal for future reference. Today's focus on phenology is the nesting activities of red-tailed hawks. During their courtship flights in late winter, excited red-tailed hawks dive at each other, sometimes locking talons and tumbling through the air together before breaking away to repeat the process again. Occasionally, a food exchange will occur when the male carries a small rodent into the air, drops it, only to have its mate retrieve it before it hits the ground. This is one of the very few times of the year that mated adult redtails can be seen perching side by side on the same branch near their nest. It's not the presence or absence of snow or green grass, it's the photoperiod, or day length, this time of year that triggers this nesting behavior. Their nest from the previous year might have been taken over by great horned owls. So, elsewhere in the pair's territory, their new nest will be placed in a tall tree in an isolated grove, or at the edge of some woodlands, or even a solitary tree in a pasture. The pair nearly always situates the nest so one or more open vistas allow it to hunt or to observe approaching danger. By late March, their nest will contain two or three white eggs spotted with brown. The bulky nest of sticks will be lined with shreds of bark and bits of fresh green vegetation. The female will incubate for 30 days or so. Young will fledge or fly for the first time in about 6 weeks in mid-June. The red-tailed hawk is the most commonly seen hawk in many areas of North America, and Iowa is no exception. By far, the red-tailed hawk is Iowa's most plentiful hawk and most certainly nests in every county in Iowa. Common to abundant throughout the year, this is the bread-and-butter hawk of the birdwatcher's list of sightings. Most red-tailed hawks are rich brown above and pale below, with a streaked abdomen. The streaked abdomen is probably the best field mark to observe, especially on the immatures. The majority have some degree of abdomen streaking or flecking, referred to as a belly band. Red-tailed hawks do not acquire their red brick tail until their second or third year. The tail of an immature red-tail is brown and banded. There are varying combinations of color, called color morphs, of red-tailed hawks. There are primarily four subgroups of these hawks called races. There is a white-appearing Kreider's race, a very dark-appearing Harlan's race, there is an eastern and a western red-tail, and there are dark phases and light phases thrown in for good measure. But each contain the red tail on the adults, and the vast majority of red-tailed hawks have some degree of flecking or the belly band. Red-tailed hawks soar above open fields, slowly turning circles on their broad, rounded wings. Other times you'll see them atop telephone poles, eyes fixed on the ground to catch the movements of metavoles or a rabbit, or simply waiting out cold weather before climbing a thermal updraft into the sky. When flapping, their wing beats are exaggerated and powerful. In high winds, they may face into the wind and hover without flapping, eyes fixed on the ground watching for the slightest movement in the grass below. They attack in a slow, controlled dive with legs outstretched. Red-tailed hawks prey upon rabbits, mice, metavoles, snakes, and they also scavenge any dead animals, like roadkills. Many folks feel compelled to refer to all hawks as chicken hawks, and this name is stuck to red-tailed hawks, being the most common. However, according to falconer Bob Anderson, as with most mammal-feeding hawks, red-tailed hawks do not have long toes. If one does pounce on a chicken or a pheasant, the prey escapes with the red-tailed hawk holding only a foot full of feathers. However, there are cousins to the red-tailed called accipiters, which have stubbier wings proportionate to their body size and long tails for ruddering through trees pursuing their prey. Accipiters are bird eaters and have longer toes to better snag and hold on to their prey. Accipiters include Cooper's hawks, sharp-shinned hawks, and goshawks. These are the hawks that take other birds, including chickens, not red-tailed hawks. Red-tailed hawks are members of the Butteo family with very broad and long rounded wings and a short, wide tail proportionally. Large red tails seen from a distance might fool you into thinking you're seeing an eagle until an actual eagle comes along and the smaller Butteo hawk becomes apparent. The red-tailed hawk's impressive piercing call is often paired with the image of an eagle in TV commercials or movies. Possibly the red-tail's piercing call is more powerful to the listeners than the high-pitched of eagles. Red-tailed hawks are called birds of prey or raptors that include eagles, falcons, owls, ospreys, harriers, vultures, and kites. Raptors are legally protected in Canada, Mexico, and the United States by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. Recently, a pair of vandals shot an eagle near Montezuma, Iowa. Their defense was, "We thought it was a hawk." And just to let you know, it is a federal crime, including heavy penalties, for shooting any raptor, including hawks. Because they are so common and easily trained as capable hunters, the majority of hawks captured for falconry in the United States are red-tails. Falconers are permitted to take only passage or young-of-the-year hawks so as to not affect the breeding population. Adults, which may be breeding or rearing chicks, may not be taken for falconry purposes, and it is illegal to do so. Passage red-tailed hawks are also preferred by the falconers because these younger birds have not yet developed adult behaviors, which will make training in older birds substantially more challenging. Generally, the falconer returns their bird to the wild after a few years. This allows falconers to begin working with another raptor. And one more raptor detail. Historically, dark-faced red-tails were referred to as Blackhawks, thus the namesake of a famous chief of the Sauk Nation, Chief Blackhawk. And that's our Focus on Phenology for today. You're listening to KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames.
And now we have... And now we have KHOY reporter Rebecca Brown, who is starting a series on folks who have become infected with wanderlust, Iowans who travel near and far. She speaks with Jerry Rupert, who is the Assistant Director of Outdoor Recreation at Iowa State University. They are discussing services for outdoor recreation for students and area residents. Jerry also shares some of his favorite traveling spots in Iowa.
First of all, how would you describe outdoor recreation services?
Most of the trips and workshops that we do are student-led, so I do a lot of leadership training. Other components that we have are we do have, obviously, trip programs. These are local, or we travel all over the country to do trips. And again, those are student-led mostly. Another component we have is we rent equipment to people. So that's one of the things that we do. They can, students, faculty, and staff can come in and rent gear and do their own trips. And then we have rock climbing walls that we have one over in Lead Recreation Center and one here. So those are the components of the program. Those are the different things that we do. As far as the program itself, what we try to do is give people an opportunity to go out in the woods and recreate and have fun.
What are all the sorts of trips that you've taken?
This program's been here a long time. It's been here over 40 years. And the one thing that's changed a little bit since I've got here is the extended trips that we do, which means traveling across the country and doing different things. And so, you know, we'll do anything from, you know, we just did a full moon cross-country ski trip on Valentine's Day, you know, which was really fun. And
where did you go for that?
Just Carr Woods right here in Ames. It's
okay.
Just over by Skunk River.
Oh.
Just off of 13th Street. It's really, really easy to get to. So, you know, a one-day, couple-hour cross-country ski trip under a full moon to horseback riding and barbecue one-day activity locally. We just did that at Jester Park down by Sailorville last fall. We do kayak day trips here. We also do overnight canoe trips here in Iowa, say on the Des Moines River, where we'll float down the river and camp on a beach and then paddle out the next day. The state parks in Iowa are awesome. They're really pretty. They're small. We do trips to a number of the state parks. Ledges State Park is 20 minutes away from here, so, and they have a lot of hiking trails there. So those are kind of the more regional, local things that we do. But then we also, we're not limited to where we can go in the United States. Our biggest trip we've ever done is we've gone sea kayaking in Alaska.
Wow.
So we flew up there. We've gone up there several times in the last 10 years or so. And I fortunately was able to lead a couple of those trips. So that's the farthest we've gone. But we'll go anywhere from surfing in California to backpacking in California in the Redwoods to mountain biking in Utah to canyoneering and rock climbing in Utah to backpacking in New Mexico. We have a new trip going out to Florida. We've done kind of before, but we're doing it all together. We're taking our own kayaks to go kayaking down in Florida.
So cool.
We just bought our own snorkeling gear.
We're
going kayaking, snorkeling, and then we chartered a boat, and they're going to take a boat out up to a place called Shell Island, and they're going to take stand-up paddle boards out there, and they're going to go stand-up paddle boarding for a day.
Do you have an underwater camera?
I'm sure there will be lots of those.
What state haven't you been to? Has outdoor rec touched every state? Or
we have done a ton of stuff in the Northeast, and the main reason for that is because most of our trips happen over breaks. And so if you think about that time frame, what are you going to do in Maine over spring break? You could go skiing and snowboarding there, but we already go to out west where the snow is way better.
Would you say it's like a break from the bustling Ames life, you know, especially during the school year for students or faculty?
It does give students an opportunity to get out of that academic realm and relax and have fun. Our trip leaders aren't required to teach them things whenever they're out there on trips, but they do. It's just part of the, unless it's a workshop, then that is educational based. But like if we go to Utah on a river trip and we come across some ruins from the 1900s, an old ranch or something like that, we'll actually talk about that and say this is what this is and this is how, you know, how it was built back in the 1900s and those types of things. So geology, biology, all that stuff we talk about when we're out there.
How did you get involved with the outdoors and outdoor recreation services?
Well, I was one of those classic high school kids. I was a total sports guy, way into it, and I wanted to be a coach and a PE teacher. And I went to a small college in Pennsylvania that was, in fact, in the local community, they call it the Teachers College. So that's where people went to become teachers. So I actually ended up staying an extra semester in undergrad and took all these new pilot courses that they were putting out there for recreation majors. and found out about it. And then after that, I learned about this school called the National Outdoor Leadership School and went out there in for a couple years after I graduated from college and spent 90 days in the wilderness in Utah, Wyoming, and South Dakota. And I'm like, yeah, this is really what I want to do. So, but then just to take it one step farther, you also have to have some kind of business, marketing, that kind of background too, to be able to do this kind of stuff. But I also had marketing as my allied field. So that's kind of my progression. I was wanted to be a teacher, got a lot of background there, then found out about the outdoor education aspect, and then went to grad school. And I've been doing this at different universities for the last 30 years.
Nice. That sounds really fun.
We all get our choice in life of what we want to do. Sometimes, not all the time. But
what's your most memorable trip experience?
I don't have one. I really don't. The one thing I really enjoy the most of is watching the students that we take out into the wilderness and see their positive experiences they have. I get a lot of gratification of seeing these big, huge smiles on their faces when they, you know, make it through a rapid that they never thought they could make it in a kayak, or if they make it, they climb a rock face that they never thought they could do, and they're just so excited about it, and that makes me feel good. So it's not the activity, it's more about the experience.
Do you get a lot of non-students either taking trips or checking out equipment?
I would say 95 to 98% of our participants are all students. And that's what it should be. That's the way it should be. Like, for example, I led a ski and snowboard trip to Steamboat Springs, Colorado once, and one of the professors wanted to go, but he wanted to bring his son from the University of Iowa. And I know it's Iowa, but we still want to go. And so that's an opportunity where he had a great experience with his son. But that son, if we would have said it's just for students, faculty, and staff at Iowa State, they wouldn't have been able to go. So we do allow a small percentage of people from outside the university to go on our trips.
If someone wanted more information about outdoor rec services and trips, where would they go?
We have our website that you can go to, the Recreation Services website at Iowa State, and then go to Outdoor Recreation. And again, that lists all these different things. And what the students have done is we actually have a Facebook account and a Twitter account now, too, that we do a lot of publicity on.
What would you say to someone that is unable to do outdoor rec because they're not a student, but they want to go on an adventure? What would you tell them?
I think it's important for parents to introduce their children to those types of things as they're growing up. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, by the time you're a college student, if you haven't been camping by then, parents, come on, really? You know, it's not all about, you know, iPads and you know, video games and stuff like that. And I'm a big believer in that. I didn't grow up in that era, but my daughter is, and I still take her out in the woods. I mean, when she was 8 years old, I took her down to the Rio Grande River on the Mexico-Texas border, and we did our own wilderness trip when she was 8 years old, you know.
What about the backyard kind of camping?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I did
putting
that as a
kid. Putting up a tent in the living room.
Yep. Putting up the tent. My daughter's had a tent in her bedroom numerous times when she was little. I always encourage people to go with people that know what they're doing. Even if you're camping at ledges or a state park or someplace like that, there's things that you need to know how to do. You need to know how to set up your tent in case the weather gets bad. You need to know how to use a stove and that type of thing. So my answer to your question is you just need to get out there and do it and go with somebody that knows how.
What are your top five places in Iowa?
You know, I'm going to tell you some that I've never been to that I've heard about. Like, for example, I've done a lot of boating over the last 20 years or so, and so I focus on that sometimes. And I hear the Upper Iowa River is just absolutely beautiful in the northeast part of the state.
Oh, yeah?
So that's really pretty. I mean, I live 5 minutes from ledges, and I took my daughter over there a million times because of the fact it's just a really pretty place. I've been in a number of state parks. I could, you know, we go up to Brushy Creek, which is just north of here, and it's really cool because we originally started doing it because they built a dam, then the trees all died, but they're still in the water, and they stick up out, all the dead limbs stick up out of the water, and we did it, went up there on a full moon and paddled through this place, and it was just really scary.
It was awesome.
Was
so creepy.
Yeah, it was
like,
so creepy on the full moon. It was so fun. So I've been to a lot of different places. Maquoketa State Park is another great one because we go caving there. That's the only place in Iowa. It's not the only place, but it's the place that has most of the caves in Iowa, and so we do a trip there. So again, you hear me talking about state parks a lot in Iowa, and I think those are kind of the gems of the state and the rivers as well.
Awesome.
Anybody can go in the outdoors. I would encourage to go with somebody that knows, has some experience and kind of knows what they're doing or really knows what they're doing. It's like I tell my students, I teach a kinesiology class. I said, I can't teach you in this classroom what I can teach you in the outdoors.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today with Susan Franson, and we were just listening to an interview with Jerry Rupert, Assistant Director of Outdoor Recreation at Iowa State University. Susan, as the KHOI County Correspondent Reporter, you've traveled to numerous towns around Central Iowa.
That's right, I have.
And you've always expressed a lot of appreciation for what's happening in the smaller communities in the area.
Yes, I really enjoy meeting the people who are making things happen. Something I have particularly enjoyed has been being able to speak with many of the mayors. One mayor who particularly impressed me was Brett Cominges, the mayor of Collins. He was actually the first mayor I met when I started reporting for KHOI. He has great energy and enthusiasm.
We have him on the phone today, right?
Yes. Hi, Brett.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Well, I'm eager to hear what's going on in Collins. I read an article recently, and it said that you signed up for something called the Iowa Retail Initiative Program. And so what is that, Brett?
Well, as a small town, we're like a lot of towns around Iowa. Well, we've suffered over a number of recent years from a depreciation in our commercial district. And I think that's indicative of every small town around Iowa because, you know, the economy's changed, demographics have changed, just things have changed. And what this organization does, they're a group of students that come out, and as a class project, they will try to work with towns in developing projects or marketing things in the community or stuff like that. So it's kind of exciting for them because they get hands-on experience, but it's great for us because we get a fresh perspective from people who maybe are thinking outside the box in ways that we're not. And hopefully at the end of the project, they can come up with a product that we can use and everybody can get better with.
Who lives in Collins, and why do they live there?
Well, I know what I'm doing in Collins. I'm trying to raise my family, and I think that's really a great way to describe it. You know, we've got generations of people that live here. You know, a lot of folks that have been around for years and years, and we've got folks who have been here, you know, just our new transplants. And I myself have only been here about 11 years, but I'm pretty committed to the idea of seeing small towns grow and survive and become more viable.
Do the people who live in Collins work in Collins?
No. That's one of the problems. A lot of times when you live in a small town, you get classified as what's called a bedroom community, and people just kind of come home and go to bed and get up the next day and go back to work. And you know, one of the complications for a small town is we've lost a lot of our services over the years because it's so much easier for a person who works at a place like Ames or Newton or Marshalltown or Des Moines or Altoona or someplace like that to just stop by at one of the big box stores on their way home and get what they got to get at a discount price and bring it home and do whatever. And over time, the small towns have lost most of what they used to offer because people didn't travel so much in the past. And now we're in a situation where, you know, we want to get some of those services back. I know we're never going to attract a big box store or we're not going to bring in a lot of chains because our market's just too small and the profit margin isn't big enough for that kind of development. But it doesn't mean that we can't bring in some services to our communities that will make the standard of living here better. And I think that's something we're committed to. I think that's something I've been, from the very beginning, had as a major priority, even though I've been derailed a number of times for other fires that keep popping up. But hopefully this is something this Iowa State Initiative can help us take advantage of.
When I visited you a couple of years ago, I noticed the big building that I believe now holds your recreation center, is that a wellness center, is that right?
A wellness center, absolutely.
And I saw that in the grant that a subset of the students, the graduate students, were working with you on that. What's that about?
Well, let me give you a little background on the wellness center itself. A couple of years ago, I guess. A number of years ago, there was another Iowa State project that came in, and as that project, they developed a comprehensive plan for the city, and one small component of that comprehensive plan was that people in Collins would appreciate having some sort of fitness center amenity. Well, the problem with that is it's hard to find, like I said before, a chain store or some of these bigger corporations that will come into a small market like ours. But I knew that there was a need. I've always known that there was a need, and there was a want, and there was a group of tapped into. Luckily, we were able to get some grants and do it ourselves. And we run a nonprofit wellness center out of an old, dilapidated building that we remodeled and upgraded and really fixed up as a fixture of our main street. And now that we've been able to do that, we've had a huge membership. We've had a lot of interest in other programming. We're up to Zumba, kickboxing, yoga, all kinds of good stuff. And what's exciting is we're still growing. And everything in there is commercial-grade equipment. It's, the whole place is debt-free. The fees are so low that it's great for anybody of any socioeconomic status. So it's really a cool place to be. In saying that, there's a lot of things we don't know about running a business, and it's a nonprofit organization. Everybody who manages the thing is either volunteer or part-time. So the idea of these people coming in to help us is part of their project, but it's also an opportunity for us to, like I said, tap into another skill set, another group of people, their ideas, and see if we can't make the place even more successful.
So, Brett, to recap, the Iowa Retail Initiative Program, that's a program of Iowa State University?
It is. It's an Iowa. And there are actually two programs in one, and what they've done is they've combined their curriculum. Part of it's an undergraduate group, girls. I shouldn't say girls, it could be anybody. These have to be girls. And there's a graduate component, too. And the graduate is intended to help the overall marketing scheme of the city of Collins. The undergraduate group is a retail initiative that is designed to help market or help bolster the accessibility and noticeability of a specific business. And they chose the Wellness Center as being that business.
And the students who participate, what are they studying at Iowa State?
You know, there's an assortment. I think that there's I think some of them have a fashion background, marketing background, things like that. I guess I have to go through individually and ask every one of them. I have a different story, but that's the department they're in.
So it's not specific to one department of the university?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that, to be honest with you. I know that one of the directors or one of the people who are running the course for the kids is in the, I think, fashion and design.
Do they seem to enjoy working in Collins?
Well, we haven't seen them a lot yet because it's a fairly new thing. They came out and had a couple-hour tour of the place, and I sat through and talked a little bit with them, and they met with our Wellness Center director and some council people, and also Drew Camp with Story County Economic Development. He's been the one kind of been in the liaison between the two of us, and so they got a pretty good vision of where we're at and where we want to be. And so far, I think a lot of stuff they're doing is on the back end, some research, some brainstorming, things like that. So. I mean, I gave them 2 years of emails and grant proposals and everything else I can scrounge up on my hard drive. So they're probably busy just looking through that stuff right now.
Well, it sounds like you've got a lot ahead of you, and we'll look forward to seeing what's happening in Collins in the next couple of years. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate that. Anytime you want to come out and work out, we'll be happy to to get you set up.
Okay, come on out and check it out. We'll check in to get a report on how the project is going, too. That sounds very interesting. And thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
Yes.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa.
We were just speaking with the mayor of Collins about a project that's occurring with Iowa State University. Iowa State University students are helping to revitalize Collins and to build a wellness center, which is becoming kind of a keystone, bringing services back into the area. I think our final guest today is Bob Inglis. The Honorable Mr. Inglis was in Ames last week. He gave a lecture called Engaging Conservatives on Energy and Climate. And Susan, you heard his lecture, and you want to tell us some about him while Rebecca calls him?
Yes, I did. I was very impressed with him and eager to bring him on to KHOI. He served for 6 years as Republican congressman from one of South Carolina's most conservative districts. Now, his title of his lecture was Engaging Conservatives on Energy and Climate. And as regular listeners may know, I'm very concerned with this issue. So I was extremely interested to hear what he said. As a conservative congressman in 2010, at a campaign event, he told an audience that he believed in human-caused climate change. He lost his election bid that year, and after leaving Congress, he established the Energy and Enterprise Initiative at George Mason University. That organization has taken on a mission to convince American conservatives that climate change is real and that free enterprise principles hold the keys for dealing with it. Hello, Bob.
Hello, how are you?
I'm so glad to be talking with you again. I'm just telling our listeners how much I enjoyed your lecture last week. And I would like you to introduce yourself a little bit the way you did to us at the lecture and tell what you were like as a congressman, the great change in your life, and how it happened.
Well, it's great to be with you, and it's great to be in Iowa recently and to be at Iowa State. So we had a great discussion there about conservatives overcoming their inferiority complex and deciding to engage on energy and climate. Unfortunately, people of my party have tended to shrink in science denial rather than stepping forward to engage. And so, but as you know, that wasn't always the case with me. I was in Congress 6 years and basically said climate change, which was a bunch of hooey, Al Gore's imagination. And then I was out of Congress 6 years. And came back with a very different approach, part because of my son telling me when I was running again in 2004, as he was voting for the first time, having just turned 18, I'll vote for you, Dad, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. So that was an important step. I love my son, his four sisters, and his mother, all of whom agree with him. So that was first step. Second step was going to Antarctica and seeing the science in the ice core drillings. And third step was being inspired by an Aussie climate scientist who shares my worldview and, because of his faith, seeks to make conservation changes in his life by as a way of loving God and loving people. And so with all of that inspiration, I came home and introduced a bill that was an alternative to cap and trade, because I think cap and trade was not the right solution. And that, as you heard the other night, Susan, got me in some trouble.
Yes. Can you give us a little detail on that? How many supporters did you have for that bill?
Well, precisely two. Dan Lipinski, a Democrat from Chicago, and Jeff Flake, a very conservative member of Congress who supported the bill. That what we have here really is an economic problem that has an environmental consequence. What we have is a market distortion in that all the costs aren't in on all the fuels. The result being that free enterprise can't deliver innovation because as long as some fuels get away with socializing their soot and avoiding that cost being attributed to their products, the competition, the competing products, the better ones, the cleaner ones, can't compete. And so rather than subsidizing those cleaner ones, which is what some people would suggest, we say eliminate all the subsidies for all the fuels and attach all the cost to all the fuels so that then you have a true cost comparison between the fuels. It's a small government answer to climate change, really.
Now, you call this carbon fee and dividend. Could you describe that, how that works?
What we're for at the Energy and Enterprise Initiative, and I invite folks to come visit us on our website at energyandenterprise.com. What we're for is this idea of a revenue-neutral tax swap. And what that revenue neutral means is that's government speak for any new tax will be paired with a cut in existing taxes or a dividend. And so the idea here would be to untax some form of income, reduce taxes, say, on corporate income taxes, personal individual taxes, or FICA, those are payroll taxes. And then because we don't want to blow a hole in the budget, we would make up that revenue by a carbon tax. The other way to do it is to pair the tax with a dividend where all the money collected goes back to the taxpayers. The benefit of this is that, first of all, for us as conservatives, there is no growth of government. The government isn't getting bigger by addressing climate change. It's actually getting smaller because if we did what I just described, some Clean Air Act regulations could be repealed because they'd become redundant. So you'd actually be shrinking the EPA, which is attractive to us as conservatives. We'd also be cutting taxes on things we want more of. We'd be reducing taxes on income and shifting the tax onto something we want less of. And, you know, even if you're like my friend Art Laffer, Ronald Reagan's economics advisor, who, if you go to our website, you'll see him saying in 2 minutes that he didn't know whether climate change is real or not. I obviously believe now that it is real and we're human caused, we need to do something about it. But he says, I don't know whether climate change is real or not. But he says he doesn't need to know. All he needs to know is we're taxing something we want more of. And we're not taxing something we maybe want less of. And he says, it's a no-brainer. Change what you tax. So we hope to equip conservatives with this perhaps new information that addressing climate change doesn't have to mean growing the government. It can actually mean shrinking the government. That, Susan, we think is one of the reasons why conservatives tend to shrink in science denial. We assume that the solution is a bigger government, and since that solution is so unacceptable, we go back to doubting whether there's a problem. It's sort of like if I, you know, told you, here's the plan of surgery for that back problem you're having. First, we're going to remove your head. Then after we've got your head off, we're going to work on your spine. Then we're going to put your head back on. And you'd probably say, thanks, doc. I'm feeling a lot better. My back isn't hurting anymore. You go back to doubting whether you had a problem because the solution is anathema. That's where conservatives are. We need to, if we can equip them with this new information, really, that hey, there's a way to do this that doesn't involve capping and trading and regulating and growing the government. There's a way to do this that involves actually an income tax cut and an EPA shrink and a way of getting China in, which is so very important.
Mr. Inglis, this is Ursula Rudenberg, and just to recap, what exactly is being taxed with the carbon tax?
What would be taxed the way that I would say is best is you do an upstream application of the tax. What that means is you visit with the 2,000 or so companies that dig coal or that send hydrocarbons down pipelines, natural gas, petroleum, and finished products. And you tax there, you apply the tax at that point based on the carbon content of those fuels.
So the level of pollution created by an energy source is what's being taxed. Is that correct?
Correct. So we know what's how much carbon is in is passing through those pipelines. We know how much carbon on average is coming out of the coal out of the mine. And so the tax is attached there. And then, of course, this is where we are quite transparent and want to be very honest. That results in an increase in energy prices all downstream. So plastics go up in price, for example, because they're made from hydrocarbons. But what they're going to is their truer cost. In other words, all the costs are being put in. No longer would people then be getting away with socializing their soot and socializing their CO2. They'd be charged for it, so their products would reflect those hidden costs, or what economists call the internalization of those negative externalities, the things that come out of those products that are negative, that aren't attached to their price. You want to put it on the price so that the free enterprise system can then judge the product. Now, of course, it's also important to start with a tax cut, though, so that as those plastics go up in price, let's say, the consumer has more money in their pocketbook so that they can afford that increase and afford to innovate, decide that, you know, I got a different way of getting that done, and I'm gonna buy this other technology.
That's a very interesting approach. As you explain it, though, it seems to me that while you might be able to convince a lot of very conservative people, certainly the insurance industry, I know, is completely on board with this, that global warming is a huge business problem for them. But how will the coal companies and the oil companies, natural gas companies, respond to this idea, and how will they block you?
Oh, yeah. Great question. Coal is not happy with it, of course, but for example, ExxonMobil is for what we're talking about. Probably surprising to many listeners that ExxonMobil would be for this, but Rex Tillerson has made a great speech where he laid out point for point what ExxonMobil would like to see in a revenue-neutral carbon tax. This is not a carbon tax that adds revenue to the government. It's revenue. It's a carbon tax that starts with an income tax cut and then replaces that revenue with a carbon tax. This is a tax swap, really. But he lays out in that speech why they're for it or what they would like to see in a carbon tax. And, of course, the why ExxonMobil will be for it is they're in the oil business and they're also in the natural gas business. In fact, they're becoming more of a gas company than an oil. And so if all the costs are in on all the fossil fuels, then natural gas beats the socks off of coal. And it stinks for coal, and it's just bad, all around bad, unless coal can figure out a way to clean up its act, to do carbon capture and sequestration. So right now, for example, what's happening in South Carolina is 6 coal-fired plants are being converted to natural gas, even as we speak. The reason is fracking and directional drilling have given us an expanded supply of natural gas, which has driven down the price, which makes it more attractive to make electricity out of natural gas than coal. And the result is that South Carolinians are breathing easier today, or will be soon, because those 6 plants are being converted. So that means that ExxonMobil would be for it because they'd have new customers. Like I say, it's tough on coal, but it's why, as a Republican rather than a Libertarian, you know, there used to be a difference. I'm a Republican, and I'd vote for, if I were still in Congress, I'd vote for basic research on carbon capture and sequestration so that we could make use of that resource, the coal resource. But we got to figure out how to burn it cleanly and how to capture that CO2. And so there are, therefore, winners and losers in this. But it's not like it's the government deciding on some basis beyond just the cost who's going to win or lose. This what we're after here is just put all the cost in on all the fuels, eliminate all the subsidies, and then see what happens. That's the free enterprise system. That's the beauty of the free enterprise system.
Well, thank you. This has been really eye-opening, I think, for a lot of people. And I would recommend the entire lecture that you gave, where you're more relaxed and have more time to really elaborate with things. And we're going to be broadcasting that next week, I believe on Tuesday, for our listeners' benefit. And just to let you know, we really appreciated your allowing us to broadcast that and for being with us today.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've just been speaking about engaging conservatives on energy and climate with former Congressman Bob Inglis. Earlier in the show, we heard from Mayor Collins, the mayor of Collins, Brett Comages.
Yes.
On improvements to which the community is working on together with the Iowa State Retail Initiative Program.
Also, KHOI reporter Rebecca Brown brought us her first travel segment with an interview with Jerry Rupert, Assistant Director of Outdoor Recreation at Iowa State University. Pat Schlarbaum gave us the phenology report with the mighty red-tailed hawk, which has started nesting now.
We've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Susan Franson. And Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison and Rebecca Brown. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
You can listen to this show and all our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. where you'll find an archive for all of the Local Talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information. There you will find a list of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources mentioned on our shows.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. And remember, Saturday night is Ames Trivia Night, which Ames Trivia Night is a fundraiser for KHOI and NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. It is not too late to sign up for a table, each of which holds a team of up to 8 people. Some teams signed up so far are the Legends on Our Own Minds, the Real Smart Club, You're Going Down, We're Yelling Timber, Real Smart Club 2, Little and the Little Green Frogs. These folks are just itching for a fight, and we invite you to rise to the occasion. Bring food, dress for the event, whatever you see fit, and of course there will be a gourmet dessert auction. The madness starts at 6 p.m. at the Boys and Girls Club, and for information, please call us at 292-2878, 292-2878 here at the station, or go to khoifm.org. You'll see a link to register at the top of our homepage, or just come and register at the event itself. It's all for two great causes, one of them being KHOI operations, so that we really hope to see you there.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email,
which is khoiradio@gmail.com.
Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
This is your KHOI community calendar for events during March 8th to the 14th, 2014. Come on out and listen to Burnin' Sensations jamming funky, soulful, popular music, which will be playing at Mother's Pub, 2900 West Street in Ames on Saturday, March 8th from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. Burnin' Sensations features our very own KHOI's Ron Carson on bass, as well as other talented musicians who bring together creative grooves and infectious melodies that will rock your world, or your night at least. Time to thaw out. There will be a 4K fun run on Saturday, March 8th, 2014 at 10 a.m. at ISU Carver Hall, starting at Campanile. All runners, joggers, and walkers are welcome. The Thawout 4K Fun Run is being offered by the Ames JCs and Heartland Senior Services as a fun and active way to raise money. Proceeds earned through the Thawout 4K Fun Run will be split equally between the Ames JCs and Heartland Senior Services and will be used to support their community outreach projects. Online registration is available at amesjaycees.com/what-we-do/events/. Or contact race director Sarah Francis at thawout4k@gmail.com. Jennifer Drinkwater will be presenting a gallery talk at the Octagon Center for the Arts, 427 Douglas Avenue, Ames, on March 11th at 7 p.m. The Octagon Center for the Arts also has various exhibits displayed currently, including clay, fiber, paper, glass, metal, wood, which is on display until April 5th in the Main and Sweeney Gallery's third floor. A solo exhibition featuring the photography of Nick Mulbauer, Accumulating Light, will be held on March 13th through March 29th, 2014, at Design on Main, located at 203 Main Street, Ames. The exhibit will be open Thursday through Friday from 4 to 7:30 p.m. and on Saturday, 10 to 1 p.m. and 4 to 7:30 p.m. There will be an open house on Friday, March 21st, 2014, from 6 to 9 p.m. with an artist's talk held at 7:30 p.m. Iowa State Theater presents Amadeus at the Fisher Theater, which will run on Friday, March 7th, starting at 7:30 p.m., Saturday, March 8th at 7:30 p.m., and Sunday, March 9th at 2 p.m. Amadeus tells a story of both fact and fiction about Mozart, one of the greatest composers who has ever lived. Mozart himself once described a genius by saying, "Neither a lofty degree of intelligence nor imagination nor both together go into the making of a genius. Love, 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 that is the soul of genius." Tickets through the Iowa State Center ticket office located on the ground floor of Stevens Auditorium in Ames, any Ticketmaster or at the door performances. This has been your KHOI Community Calendar for the week. I'm Elizabeth Kutiepov, and remember to support KHOI Community Radio with your pledges. KHOI is run by volunteers, and we really appreciate your support to keep this radio station running. Thanks for listening.